Welcome to The Fader Interview. I'm Alex Robert Ross, editorial director of The Fader. Since his HBO series How To began in October 2020, John Wilson has been arguably the premier archivist of New York City, its people, and its culture. But this is not a tourist-friendly collection of iconic landmarks and recognizable characters. Wilson starts each episode with an objective: learn how to improve his memory or how to invest in real estate, for example, but uses the premise as an excuse to let his eye wander across a city that provides a constant stream of inspiration. The results are hilarious, intimate, freewheeling, and wildly unpredictable. A particularly memorable episode, in which Wilson seeks out ways to prevent his cat from destroying his furniture, winds up with him meeting a circumcised man who is attempting to regrow his foreskin. The 36-year-old filmmaker remains behind the camera, commentating nervously on everything he observes. The end product is somewhere between cinema verite and watching someone play a video game where the side quests become the main focus. If this sounds to you like something with a relatively short shelf life, you're not wrong. It's a minor miracle that something so strange has existed in a TV landscape filled with unimaginative reboots and savage cancellations. This, in part, is why Wilson has decided that the upcoming third season of How To, starting this Friday, July 28 on HBO, will be the last. Speaking from his New York home, the same one he lived in above his beloved landlady, Mama, Wilson says he'd be happy to let the show run and run, but is conscious that he's pulled off something incredible, and wants to end it before any possible decline sets in. The move was supported by his executive producer, Nathan Fielder, a fellow comic innovator who blurs the line between artifice and reality. In a conversation carried out earlier this month, Wilson told The Fader's David Renshaw about leaving How To behind, the many lessons he's learned along the way, and what he hopes to pursue next.
Yeah, I guess the obvious place to start is the fact that this third series, which begins on HBO on July the 28th, is going to be the final season of How To with John Wilson. Could you explain a little bit why you felt now was the right time to draw a line under the series?
When I started to kind of conceive of season three, like right when season two was ending, I got kind of excited by thinking of it as the last season because I was able to kind of unlock a few things that I feel like I wasn't really able to do in the first couple of seasons. I feel like there's a lot more personal stuff in this season. I think we do some other ambitious stuff and reveal other things about the kind of production that I just wanted to save for, you know, kind of the ending. I mean, at the end of the day, the best thing you can do is leave people wanting more. This isn't the end of my career. It's just the end of this particular project with this name, I think. I've been making how-to movies for like 13 years at this point. You know, I was making them independently for about a decade before the show started. So it's been a long time.
Because How To is a series that feels, as a viewer, very unpredictable and surprising to watch, which I think is part of its success with the fans. How hard is it to keep that element of surprise as you approach a third season?
I always want the imagery and the content to feel really surprising. And I never want to push it past a point where it begins to, you know, feel redundant, because the city does have a lot of amazing imagery in it. And you know, I don't think you can ever really run out of people to talk to. I think there's a kind of a value system that Fielder especially kind of drilled into me, which is just like, once we do something once, we'd never do it again. I just wanted to make sure that it felt unpredictable up until the very last moment. And I knew I could do that by kind of capping it at around three seasons. I started to think about what the project would look like if it just went on indefinitely. It felt like it might start to meander because, you know, there are a lot of different elements in the show that kind of make up the whole picture. One big part of it is the memoir material. One big part of it is studying the way that cities are designed, infrastructure stuff. I knew that having it be so personal was going to continue to kind of make it more difficult to be sustainable during the long term. So I just wanted to make sure that I was like just keeping it contained to what I wanted to reveal. I don't regret anything I've ever put into the show. And I think it was genuinely kind of therapeutic and I think much richer, like by having that stuff in there. I just wanted to make sure it ended on a strong note.
So you mentioned Nathan Fielder there a moment ago. He's a producer on How To, has been since it debuted on HBO. He is someone who obviously knows about ending a show, a beloved show at the right time, I think. He did that with Nathan For You. What were the conversations like with him when you raised the idea that maybe this was going to be it?
Nathan was supportive. You know, he also ended Nathan For You after four seasons. You know, that was a voluntary decision on his part. I think he felt a similar way where he just didn't want to push it to the point where people were getting bored of the same old shtick. A lot of my, you know, favorite stuff only had a few seasons or, you know, less than that. I mean, Jackass only had three seasons. Look how long of a tail that project had. Twin Peaks only had three seasons, even though it was, you know, over the course of 20, 30 years or something. I try not to like focus on this being the end of things too much. I mean, I won't be able to stop shooting regardless.
You described the upcoming third season as some of the most ambitious narrative ideas that you've had to date for the show. I was curious, obviously without spoiling anything, if you could kind of shed any light on what that entails. What is the ambition that you're showing with these new episodes?
It's very hard to describe without spoiling anything. Yeah, you're just going to have to wait and see. I try to keep this stuff pretty close to the vest. I very much am like, yeah, I want to keep the element of surprise intact.
For series two, you brought comedian Conor O'Malley and the journalist and author Susan Orlean onto the writing team. Were there any additions or new faces to the room for series three?
Yeah, there was one episode where we got Steven Soderbergh to consult, which, you know, you might be able to tell which episode that is when you watch it, but that was a really cool collaboration.
Wow, what was it like working with him?
It was cool. We just kind of sent him a script for, you know, a rough script for one episode and got on the phone with him and talked with him about it. And he gave us some advice about how to do some of the more ambitious stuff within it. We had a nice time talking. He was wearing a Cheesecake Factory hat during one Zoom. You know, I was saying I'd never been there, and he was talking about how much he likes that place because of how well oiled the operation is and how big the menu is. And I think he really likes just watching people do like big jobs very efficiently. We also bonded over our love of Below Deck, which we both watch a lot. I didn't realize he was a fan, but I guess he has dinner with Captain Lee sometimes, which is cool.
Wow. Yeah, he's famously, at the end of every year, kind of publishes everything he watched that year in a very kind of, I mean, I appreciate, but some people may be perturbed by just quite how catalogued it is. It's kind of like Tuesday, March the 23rd, two episodes of Below Deck and some movie from the 70s. And that's obviously something you've kind of revealed in the show, is that you also like to log information about your life regularly.
Yeah, I definitely like felt a connection there. Someone had told me that he put How To on his roundup list of stuff he watched. So that's why I felt kind of comfortable reaching out to him. But yeah, I haven't like looked at anything else he's really watched. Yeah, there is a kind of mutual obsession there. Even the most banal stuff, just cataloging it, you don't know what kind of purpose it'll serve in the future.
I was curious, as someone who's documented New York for a long time, what, if any, are some of the most significant shifts that you've observed in the 3+ years that you've been making How To?
I feel like, I mean, you know, the landscape has obviously changed a lot. And I think it's really cool that COVID shacks on the sidewalk and street are becoming more permanent. That feels like a nice thing for street life. You know, people ask me whether or not, you know, people are more or less open to talking like pre or post pandemic. And I haven't really noticed much of a difference. I mean, I think if anything, people want to talk a little more after the pandemic, just because they've been isolated for so long. But things in New York are just constantly changing, and that's what makes it like the best home base for a project like this. Things that you thought were going to last forever just end up disappearing, and suddenly that piece of footage you have becomes a lot more valuable than you originally thought.
Obviously, the Fader podcast is traditionally, we have musicians regularly on as guests. You're one of our first non-musical guests. When you look back over the sort of many, many hours of footage you've banked over the years, are there any kind of music-related moments that stand out to you as being particularly memorable?
Yeah, there was the guy I filmed for the episode about wine who was playing a kind of a glass harp in the subway station. You know, like all the wine glasses just filled with, you know, different sizes and stuff like that. And there's something really beautiful about trying to play one of the quietest instruments, you know, like that you can have in one of the loudest environments there is. That was really pretty. But yeah, there's a lot of musical moments all over New York.
Have you ever done anything like in your career, kind of making music videos or documentaries or anything like that? I mean, are you a particularly big music fan? Is that a thing you're interested in, or is it not so much?
I used to make more music video stuff when I first started making films, you know, just like for friends and stuff. But I don't make them anymore, and I haven't made them for a long time because they felt kind of like hollow to me. I didn't want to make anything that was just kind of a style exercise. You know, I didn't want to get caught up in just like working on some piece that was just more of a mood. You know, I kind of wanted to only make essay stuff for a while.
That's interesting that you're very obviously committed to your style and an expert in the way that you make things. With the success of How To, have you been presented the opportunities or offers to do something that is maybe what most people may consider a bigger opportunity, but that just doesn't work for you? I'm thinking of like this kind of pipeline from indie filmmaker to blockbuster. It seems very quick and very well established at this point of time. Are people kind of coming to you and saying, you know, are you interested in doing this kind of thing? And you're pushing back on those chances? Is that a situation you found yourself in?
Yeah, people definitely ask me to act and stuff sometimes, or do other voiceover work, but I really didn't have the bandwidth to do anything else while I was making How To. I wanted to be fully dedicated to that while I was doing it. I think moving forward, I'm open to doing other stuff. It would have to be the right project. I have a single line in the Aqua Teen Hunger Force movie that came out this past year. They asked me to do that, and It took like, you know, 20 minutes. My character is off screen and I'm not even credited, and I have one line. And they sent me a few DVDs, and that was pretty much it. But, you know, I was a fan of that when I was growing up, so I just thought it would be funny.
I wanted to also speak about some of the people that you've highlighted over the years and kind of met and spoken to and portrayed in the series. Do you keep in touch with these people? Are you kind of, I'm sure you're not kind of all on a group text or anything, but you know, are there people that you've kind of kept in touch with, maintained contact? What's kind of the situation with some of these people that we've met along the way?
You know, it's hard to like keep in touch with everybody because, you know, there's a lot of people, you know, I do travel a lot in the show, and you know, these people are all over the country, but you know, a lot of the people that I shoot just in New York just kind of live in my neighborhood, so I see them all the time. Like the neon guy that I talked to in the How to Split the Check episode, he lives very close and I just see him at the bar all the time. There's other people like the circumcision guy or the Mandela Effect guy that, you know, or they're always posting on Twitter and stuff like that, and will like message every now and then. You know, if people reach out, I'll obviously like keep a dialogue open, but like people also just like don't reach out to me.
And how about Mama, your landlord? How is she doing?
I think she's good. Yeah, I haven't talked to her in a few months, but I think she's still in Vegas, and you know, I still get her mail and stuff. So I have to let her know when she gets anything important.
I was very interested to know your thoughts on a subject that feels like it runs kind of concurrent to what you do, if being entirely different at the same time, which is the subject of privacy in the age of social media. And, you know, there's a tendency among people now to kind of start filming the moment anything happens. And they'll often share that footage online, which can have a negative impact on the subject of the video. As someone who documents the public for a living, obviously through a much more sympathetic lens, what's your position on this debate?
I think it's very easy to get it wrong, which is why, you know, on the surface, I am filming a lot of people in public, and my B unit team is, you know, they're filming a lot of people on the sidewalk, but there's a lot of stuff that we don't use, you know, because it just doesn't feel right. You know, when I put the voiceover and stuff in it, like I try to make sure that the subject of the joke is like me or, you know, us as viewers and not necessarily like the person that's on screen. But yeah, I mean, people shoot a lot of stuff all the time, and you know, it's hard to make like a blanket statement about, you know, the ethics of that. But I feel like when you live in a big city, there's a certain expectation that when you're out in public, you are being filmed either by security cameras or, you know, other people filming their own personal content. Not to say that you shouldn't expect like a, you know, some kind of privacy. I feel like it's just important to consider like why you're broadcasting what you're broadcasting. And, you know, I don't ever want people to feel nervous around me thinking that I might do something nefarious with their image.
Have you ever had any kind of feedback from people who were maybe either themselves or on behalf of a person who has been in the show kind of upset by the way, by what they've seen?
I don't think so. There was one person from the Mandela Effect conference that didn't want to be in it after the fact, so we just took them out. But for stuff on the sidewalk, no, not that I know of.
You mentioned a moment ago the team that you work with, which is an interesting part of the show that I think maybe is lesser known. It has this very DIY nature, and it kind of feels like you're out there doing everything yourself. But obviously you do work with a team of a camera crew and people who capture footage on your behalf. Could you speak a little bit about how that system works and how you organize these people? And, you know, are they left to their own devices? Do you give them direction? What's kind of the setup?
So a typical production day will be like, I am kind of A unit, and I will be either out on the sidewalk just trying to chase some story about restrooms or whatever the subject of the day is. I will talk to random people, or I'll have like an interview set up with like an expert or something like that. Simultaneously, there's about four or five teams of second unit B-roll shooter people that go out every day, and there's like a field producer which with each shooter. So it's like a two-person team for each like set of B unit people. And they go out and they have a scavenger hunt list of a bunch of different stuff that I would like to put into each episode. You know, whether it's like houses that look like faces or, you know, bottles of urine on the street. And they will just kind of come to the office in the morning, and then I have this guy, Ted Day. He kind of dispatches all of the different shooters to different parts of New York City just so we can cover enough, as much ground as we can. And if they don't always know what neighborhood to go to, they'll usually just throw a dart at a map of New York City and just go wherever the dart lands. Just to randomize it as much as they can. And then they shoot all day, and then I get back home and I get all of the footage that they shot, and I scrub through all of it and I make selects and I try to find patterns within it. And then I tell them to shoot stuff that, you know, like once we have two of something, I then ask them to get like more of it. You know, if it's people wearing a certain kind of shirt, or if it's just like a bunch of cables that are all twisted up in front of a house, you know, just like try to get as many of those as you can. It's just an iterative process. We just keep like doing that over and over again until we have enough for a season.
One thing I was thinking about, and that I've thought about a lot watching How To over the last couple of seasons, is you're clearly someone who's very focused on what is real, what is true. What, like you said, the music videos to you felt hollow, and this doesn't. The humanity of the series really shines through. As someone with that kind of mindset, to what extent are you conscious of reality being distorted by your camera and the fact that it's being filmed for a TV show? Do people change once they know they're being filmed? And have you become adept at spotting someone who's perhaps putting on a show?
I feel like I understand what the camera does to a room. I like to lean into that, because I think what a lot of nonfiction filmmakers or documentarians do is they try to hide the fact somehow that there's a camera filming everything, and they try to just document something and make the subjects pretend like there's nobody else there. To me, that, like, the fact that I am there filming adds like a really unique tension to the whole scene, and like actually engaging with the subject from behind the camera, I feel like the least artificial way for me to conduct an interview, because otherwise, you know, they're not supposed to look at the camera or whatever. I mean, it depends on the project, you know, but I feel like a lot of the time people just are themselves on camera. And even if you start recording and they change like a tiny bit, it's still like some version of themselves. I have shot with a couple of people who were way too hammy, like almost like disgustingly so. And I just cut them out, because it's almost like they learned how to behave on reality TV or something, and it just it felt kind of useless to me. Like, they just kept making jokes, and you know, they didn't realize that wasn't the kind of the vibe of the project. I don't know. But then there's people like the CEO of the energy drink company who I talked to in the wine episode. You know, he's clearly very kind of media trained and has almost like a way of speaking that he's kind of polished over a lot of social media content. And there's something really cool about that as well, because, you know, it's almost like tipped over past the point of just performance into like, this is now his identity, you know, which is really cool.
One other thing I wanted to discuss is you've crossed into a territory, a very small group of kind of what you would call name documentary makers, you know, people who perhaps are not consuming huge amounts of non-fictional movies and TV shows would know your work. Are there any people that you would like to kind of either working currently, or people who you grew up idolizing that you would like to kind of shout out and turn people onto who are fans of your work?
Yeah, I mean, I think people should really check out Frederick Weissman's work. You know, he's like a major inspiration to me. You know, he's been making documentaries for decades, you know, like since the 60s. And, you know, they could be a little hard to locate sometimes, but he just makes these incredible documentaries that are just called like High School or Aspen or Primate, you know, all single subject. And there's this kind of purity to them where he there's no talking heads. He's just filming what's happening in the moment in these different environments and kind of bureaucratic places. Yeah, there's Penelope Spheeris, you know, I really like a lot, you know, who made all the Decline of Western Civilization movies. I love when a filmmaker can so seamlessly, you know, go back and forth between like really amazing documentary, but then also make, you know, Wayne's World and do both, and both are just perfect, you know.
Is that something that appeals to you, the idea of being able to try a different medium?
Yeah, totally. There's one episode this season where I kind of dip my toe in that world. It's really fun. I really like those filmmakers that make Hollywood stuff now, but started out making really cool documentaries, like Todd Phillips, I think, made The Hangover. But he also started out by making that frat house documentary or the Gigi Allen That Hated documentary, Terry Zwigoff with like the Crumb stuff. And then he went on to make all that other stuff. I feel like that's inspiring, but I don't know if I can direct actors, you know, so I don't know if I'll ever get there.
I think we're heading towards the end of our time together. I wanted to kind of ask you to look back over the three seasons of How To, and maybe tell me the thing you feel most proud about having finished this project.
I'm still kind of in awe, just looking back at everything, thinking about like how much kind of lightning we were able to bottle in a way. It terrifies me to think what it would be like if we weren't in like that exact place at that exact time, shooting that exact thing. It like gives me nightmares. I don't know. I'm really glad that we were able to like have the freedom to do that kind of stuff, because it's rare to have the kind of resources that we had, like with HBO, to basically create whatever prop we wanted or just like chase whatever lead, you know, we wanted that, you know, sometimes just ended up nowhere and we ended up not using it. But yeah, I feel like the kind of lesson overall that I got from it is just to try as many things as possible and kind of never say no once someone invites you to do something or go somewhere, just being a genuinely curious team.
Has there ever been a point, you know, that you've kind of genuinely felt out of your comfort zone and a bit, not in a safety way, but just a bit like, I don't know what to do next moment making this series over the last few years?
Yeah, I've been in a lot of situations like that, but the way out of any uncomfortable situation to me is just to keep asking questions, you know, and I think that it works that way just socially, even if I'm not filming with a camera or anything, because I think people would just rather talk about themselves. So if if I'm ever like, you know, nervous or don't really know what the right thing to say is, then questions are always help. And also just like, if you're having like a genuine conversation, if I reveal something about myself in a conversation, that will then motivate someone to kind of match you on that level in a way, or try to one-up you sometimes. That's really helpful. Not that it's like an insincere conversation. I think like there's a lot that you don't see in the show that we film, you know, that a lot of the interviews are much longer dialogues where I'm talking a bit more about myself, and we use that here and there. But like when you engage that way, I think like people feel more comfortable like opening up about their own stuff.
That was John Wilson talking to the Faders' David Renshaw. The third season of his HBO series, How To with John Wilson, comes to Max this Friday, July 28. The Fader interview is engineered by Tony Giambroni. The executive producer is Alex Robert Ross, and the associate producer is Raphael Helfand. We'd like to thank Lauten Audio for providing our microphones. You can find them online at lautenaudio.com. And we'd like to thank James Ivy for providing our intro music. If you enjoyed today's episode, we'd appreciate if you left a 5-star rating and review. And keep an eye on thefader.com for essential music news, interviews, and essays. We'll be back soon with another episode of The Fader Interview. Goodbye until then.